Frank Buckley. This time on the program, we're talking about something that many of us are experiencing right now, some more profoundly than others. We're talking about grief. We've lost so many people to the pandemic, and all of us have lost someone or at least some things. Maybe it's our sense of normalcy, our daily rhythms, our human connection, so many of the things we took for granted before the arrival of COVID-19. Our guests today are going to tell us how they've dealt with grief with hopes that it will help all of us. One of them is an expert on grief, David Kessler. He's the author of the best-selling book, Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief, and five other books. He's also the founder of Grief.com. But first, we're speaking with Melissa Gould. Melissa knows grief because she experienced it in the worst way. She lost the love of her life, Joel, to a virus. 7 years ago, Joel, who was living with MS, suddenly became very ill. It turned out to be West Nile virus. And when Joel died, Melissa was left alone to raise her then 13-year-old daughter, Sophie, to move forward with her own life as a widow in her 40s. She writes about it in the number one Amazon bestseller, Widowish.
And I am delighted to welcome Melissa Gould to the program. Melissa, congratulations on a wonderful book that, as I told you earlier, made me cry and made me laugh. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's so nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I wonder the title, Widow-ish. Why did you call it Widow-ish?
You know, so much of it had to do with the fact that I didn't look like a widow because I was young. I was in my 40s. I had a 13-year-old daughter, like you mentioned. I didn't look like a widow, and I wasn't necessarily acting like a widow. And by that, I mean, you know, my daughter was an only child. I say I became an only parent. So people saw me out in the world, you know, going to the market, picking up my daughter from school, living my life. But I felt like a widow. And I continue to feel like a widow. So it was those things, really, of not looking like a widow, not acting like a widow, but feeling like one. I kind of decided that I was widow-ish.
You know, as you know, we have mutual friends. We're both Studio City people. People who knew you as a couple talked about how wonderful you were as a couple and as a family. Joel was dealing with MS, but living and having a full life despite that diagnosis. And then he fell ill. And can you talk us through that and what happened?
Yeah, so, you know, he was diagnosed with MS in 2008. And we were managing. Obviously, some changes needed to be made to his life, our lifestyle. MS affects your mobility. Joel was a very active guy. But once he got on the right course of treatment and medication, he was doing well, and we were managing our lives with the MS. In 2013, his health took a turn for the worse, and the MS was affecting him in ways that it hadn't. So we switched medication, which is protocol for these kinds of autoimmune diseases. And it was in the switching of the medication that sort of lowered his already fragile immune system. And I write about it in the book, but he suddenly one day just was not feeling well. He had a high fever. He would take Tylenol, the fever would go down, but it didn't look like MS. It looked more like the flu, but we really had no idea what it was. We ended up going to the hospital. We made that decision together. Joel walked himself in. And 2 days later, he fell into a coma. The doctors had no idea what was going on with him. They thought that this was perhaps a reaction to the new medication he had started. But it was bad, and things got grim and very scary very quickly. And it took about 2.5 weeks of Joel being in the hospital in a coma for the doctors to realize that he had been bitten by a mosquito, he had West Nile virus, and he was dying.
Yeah. And there is a moment where in your book, a doctor pulls you aside and he says something that really struck me, which was, is Joel a man of dignity? Tell me what that doctor was really asking you.
Well, you know, there were so many doctors in the hospital, Frank. There were so many, you know, there were pulmonologists and neurologists and infectious disease doc. Every day there were new doctors coming in. I was meeting different doctors. They were all giving me their opinions about what may or may not be happening to my husband. And this one doctor was a pulmonologist, and she pulled me aside and she asked me, what, you know, is Joel, is your husband a man of dignity? And I said, yes, and quality of life is everything to him. And she said, okay, well, what I think we're looking at is he may be able to hold a comb one day, but he won't know what to do with it. Hmm. And when you hear that about your person, you know, the person who is your everything, my husband, the father of our daughter, it really sent me spinning.
Yeah.
And that was one of the worst moments in the hospital, but it also was the thing that sort of changed. It's the moment where I became what I thought was also Joel's voice, because every decision I was making in the hospital, and there were decisions every single day that I was making, but Joel was non-communicative and non-responsive, and I started to kind of channel, what would Joel do? What would Joel want? What would Joel say about everything that was going on? And so I thought I had to kind of put my feelings and all of my fears aside and really connect with my husband.
And it's a decision that many people today who are grappling with COVID have to deal with their loved ones. And that is, you essentially have to decide whether to push for extreme medical intervention or to allow the person to go. And in your case with Joel, you had to make that decision. And can you tell us how difficult that is and what helped you through that?
In some ways, it was, of course, the most difficult decision I ever had to make and hopefully will ever have to make in my life. And in other ways, it was a very clear decision because, like you said, with the exception of there being extreme medical interference, Joel, at this point, was brain damaged. He was paralyzed. One day he was paralyzed from the waist down. The next day he was paralyzed from the neck down. I mean, these were the things every day for 3 weeks I was hearing in the hospital. And so, you know, after much consideration, and again, what I had just said a minute ago about channeling Joel and what would Joel want, this was no life. This was no, you know, when the one doctor asked me if he was a man of dignity and my response was quality of life, there was no life left for Joel to live.
Right. After that, of course, Joel did die, and we're going to take a short break right now. We're going to talk to Melissa Gould about how she continued with her life. We're going to talk about her book, Widow-ish, when we come back.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
We're back again with Melissa Gould. Her book is Widow-ish. And Melissa, Joel, you were telling us how you had just made the decision that you would let him go because of his state. And then Joel does die. You write about a very poignant scene there, and I don't want to dwell on that right now, because I want to talk about how you moved on with your life. And that's one way to put it, but I was wondering, do you ever move on, as some people would say?
No, you move forward. That's what happens, because grief doesn't ever really leave you. You kind of learn to live with it, and you just move forward. And I say that grief is just a constant companion.
You had Sophie as your constant companion as well. She was 13 years old at the time. And the one thing that I get in your book is that, and we all know that people grieve differently. You're trying to guide your daughter through her grief. And one thing that came through to me was that even as a 13-year-old child, you have different feelings from your mom. And that, how did you navigate that?
Yeah, that was difficult. I mean, I really made Sophie my focus, and I was so grateful to have her to focus on, because I wanted to be strong for her, and I also wanted her to know it was okay to be grieving. And, you know, we did grieve very differently. I was crying all the time, everywhere, all over the place. She held things much closer to the vest. But therapy helped for us. You know, I wanted to make sure she had somebody other than me to talk to about everything that she was experiencing as a young girl who just lost her father.
And you eventually start dating Sophie's guitar teacher. And it sort of happened organically, as you write about in the book. How did it come to be that you ended up dating Sophie's guitar teacher?
You know, it was at a time when, you know, for that whole first year, people were so kind and would often ask me, is there anything I can do? Do you need help with anything? And I ran into Marcos one night, and like everybody else at the time, he asked if there's anything I can do to help. I heard about Joel, and, you know, and he knew Joel better, like Joel knew Marcos better than I knew Marcos, because guitar fell under Joel's jurisdiction. And so I had only met him a handful of times at most. I didn't really know him, but when I saw him that night and he offered to help with anything, I had actually been going through Joel's things. It was the time when I was just kind of like needed to process that he was no longer home, no longer living in the house. I started to get rid of some of his things. Among them were a ton of musical equipment that Joel had in our garage. There were guitars and amplifiers. And so I said, and I didn't know what to do with any of it. And so I said to Marcos, actually, yes, I have all of this music stuff and I don't know what to do with it. And if you wouldn't mind, you can have some of it. You can give it to your students, whatever you want, but I just don't know what to do. And he was like, of course, I'll come over. I'll help you. And he did. And again, our meetings at the time were brief. He was all business, came in, kind of sorted through what we had, and was really very helpful. And I appreciated not only his help, but the fact that he spoke very easily about Joel. And, you know, most people were afraid to talk to the widow. They thought they would say something wrong, or they didn't know if it was okay to talk about Joel, if they should mention him, if they shouldn't. But Marcos was very comfortable talking about Joel, and I appreciated that so much. And so that just led to us getting to know each other in a way. And one day we went out to lunch, and we kind of just got to know each other better. And I mentioned earlier, a friend had given me the advice to just keep things easy. And so I didn't overthink it. There was like the tingling sparks of maybe something happening between us, but I was so deep in my grief that I just kind of allowed it to happen.
Within 9 months, you're at a party. It's the first time you guys appear in public together. And one thing that really I felt for you was that moment where you walk into a party and you immediately feel judged by someone you know. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, that also contributed to the whole idea of being widow-ish. It was this kind of perception of what a widow should be doing, how a widow should be acting. I started dating, like you said, Sophie's guitar teacher. It just happened. I didn't overthink it. You know, I write about in my book how a friend had given me the advice to just keep things easy, make everything in my life easy. So when I started dating Marcos, that was in my head. I'm not going to overthink this. I'm just going to go with this. And, you know, we're still together this many years later. And there was a lot of judgment. And at that party, somebody, you know, we walked in. I was very nervous and anxious about it, but I was glad to have somebody with me. And this woman basically said to me, "You're here on a date. When did your husband die?" And I kind of had been dealing with that at that moment, and from that moment forward for a while, a lot of judgment.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, did at a certain point, because you write about this, it seems like this internal struggle about whether you should be doing this. And how do you give yourself permission to do this?
I think the permission came from that idea of just keep things easy. Like it didn't feel wrong. You know, I felt like Joel would want this for me. He wouldn't want me to be bereft and home alone and crying. You know, he would want me to be out in the world. We were a very vibrant couple, and, you know, we lived our lives and we had a lot of friends and we entertained a lot. And, you know, he was in the music industry. We went to shows all the time. So I felt like this is what Joel would want. And that was the other thing too, like, because Marcos was in the picture fairly early, I didn't want people to think that I was over Joel. And even to this day, this many years later, I still feel like Joel is in my life, and Joel's always going to be my husband. And Marcos and I have this wonderful relationship, and I write about this in the book, but he at one point said he was the man for the job, you know, because I was afraid of dating a widow. Like, are you sure you want to date a widow? And he was like, I'm the man for the job. And he has continued to be.
You mentioned something that I want to go back to, which is this idea that people didn't know what to say to you. They felt awkward about it. If we are in that position today, especially with what's happening with the pandemic, and we know someone who's suffered a loss, what should we do?
You know, to me, the acknowledgement was enough for people just to say, I'm so sorry, or I'm thinking about you. I didn't necessarily want to be asked, how are you? Mm. How are you doing?
Yeah.
So just making a statement, I'm thinking of you. I heard about what happens. You're in my thoughts. I'm sorry for your loss. For me, that was enough.
What would you say to people who find themselves in a similar situation, because we are experiencing it a lot right now, where people are suddenly widows or widowers? They want to have their lives continue to move on, to move forward, as you put it.
Yeah.
How do we best help them to do that?
You know, I think there is no one way to grieve. And I think that grief is a very personal thing, and everybody is going to manage it differently. And I just really want people who are experiencing this, and certainly in COVID, it's just ubiquitous in our world right now, which is so sad. But I want people who are experiencing grief and the loss of a loved one to just be kind to themselves. You know, there's no right or wrong to any of this.
Right.
And I think just being kind to yourself is really the best way to move forward, and give yourself the time and whatever it is you need to get through your grief, it's okay.
Yeah. The book, again, is Widowish by Melissa Gould. You can buy it now on Amazon, where it is a number one Amazon bestseller and an editor's pick. You will laugh and you will cry and you will be glad that you read this book. Melissa, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Bite.
The pandemic has left all of us dealing with grief. Some of us are suffering through the profound loss of a loved one. Others are dealing with the grief of losing aspects of their lives, whether it's a job, school, being with friends and family, or just a sense of normalcy. Most of us have experienced some level of grief. Here to help us is David Kessler, the author of the best-selling book, Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief, and five other books. He's also the founder of Grief.com. David, welcome. It's great to have you on the program.
Good to be with you, Frank.
We just heard the moving and compelling story of Melissa Gould. I know you were listening along. She told us about her journey of grief, and I hope people will find something in her story to help them. But I would imagine that you would tell us that everyone's journey is unique.
Absolutely. It's as unique as our fingerprint. And a couple of things she brought out that I think were so helpful is grief is a no-judgment zone. We're all going to do it differently. There's no comparing. And I'll tell you, people always ask me, which is the worst loss? Is it the death of a child, the death of a husband, the pandemic? I always tell people, the worst loss is your loss. Mm.
And are there common questions that come to you in grief? Are there common concerns? What are some of those?
Well, the biggest loss we go through is the death of a loved one. And I think people want to know, how long is the grief going to last? Mm. When is my loved one going to be over it or move on? And I always say to people, how long is a person going to be dead? If they're going to be dead for a long time, you're going to grieve for a long time. It doesn't mean you will always grieve with pain, though. That's the key, that in time, we can grieve with more love than pain. As long as we allow this to happen.
Mm. How do I let it happen? Because when I've suffered pain like this, I've had to immediately take action, whether it was taking care of the arrangements or those sorts of things. And I didn't have time at that moment to grieve. And I found it coming out later, years later at times. And is that a common thing?
Very, very common. You know, we have this myth. I talk about early grief. If I went down to the mall or the street and said to a random person, how long, when's early grief? People would say first month, first week. Early grief is the first 2 years of grief.
Mm.
So we often have these expectations that grief is something that lasts a year or a month, and it's not true. So if we understand, we allow it. Now, it's interesting, Frank. I never thought this would happen. When I was researching the new book, I literally ended up studying buffaloes. Buffaloes sense a storm coming. And when they sense a storm coming, they run into the storm and minimize their discomfort. We run from grief and stay in pain longer.
I see.
Because we do run.
And how do I confront that grief? What are some tools that you can give me to confront that grief and to lessen that pain?
To talk about it, to talk about your loved one. Grief needs dedicated time. Not a lot. It's maybe just in the shower before work. And what other people think of your grief is actually none of your business. Hmm. The world's going to think you're grieving too long, too short, grieve differently. You have to figure out what's right for you.
Hmm. We heard Melissa talk about the fact that when she started to date, she felt instantly judged. You've talked about the fact that it is a no judgment zone, but people do judge. How do you deal with that when you are the one being judged in your grief?
Well, I love that she didn't let it change what felt right for her. She knew she was keeping it easy. She knew how her husband, Joel, had felt. That was what was right for Melissa. It might not be right for someone else, but it was right for her, and she allowed herself to go down the path that felt okay for her.
We've talked about what it's like to grieve when someone dies, the most profound loss that we can experience. But what about those more, I'd call them mundane losses, like I want to go out to a restaurant next weekend with friends, but I really can't anymore. I want to go to the movies. I really can't do that anymore. All of these sort of things that make up life, we've been losing over the past several months. They seem mundane in some ways, and yet they really do affect us.
Yeah, it's interesting. We think of grief as around death, but there's macro griefs and micro griefs. In other words, big and small. Big is the death of a loved one. However, we have all lost the world we knew a year ago. That world isn't coming back. Like you, I go out to the boulevard, the local street. Another restaurant's closing. I feel sad. People have postponed weddings. Their jobs are ending. We can't just enjoy life. The sadness, the discomfort people are feeling, people go, I don't know why I'm crying. Because you're grieving the world that has gone. You're grieving all these moments. Now, the key is to realize there is no dark night that will last forever. There is no storm that won't pass. This is painful. It's hard. People are dying. And we will get through this. We can find meaning in time. We can honor those who have died.
When Melissa was talking about this confronting of death before Joel even died, can you talk about what those experiences are like for the people that you work with when the person they love hasn't died, but is in effect gone? He was in a coma. Is that common, what she experienced?
Absolutely. It's called anticipatory grief. And it's all of us have a healthy anticipatory grief. We know someday down the road, years from now, our parents are going to get older. We're going to lose them. That's normal anticipatory grief. When a loved one gets a diagnosis, gets really sick, we go into grief also. I tell people, Melissa obviously had very little time, but sometimes you have anticipatory grief over the years with a chronic illness or Alzheimer's. And my rule is, I tell people, don't attend the funeral early. If they're still alive, still make the most out of the time you have, and you will grieve when you get to the funeral.
I think people feel guilt about some parts of grieving. Even in the case of Melissa, when you're grappling with questions like the one that she was asked by the doctor, is he a man of dignity? And she had to decide what that meant. Would he want to be kept alive with extreme medical intervention, or would he want to have some quality of life? No matter what you decide, you may feel guilt with that. How do people process that?
Well, Frank, it's a really important question. And I'll tell you, my work is also in end-of-life care and hospice and palliative care and ICUs. I'll tell you, we have the misperception that we're bringing about their death. The reality is their body is dying. And the question is, do we add artificial external support in that moment, or do we let the body naturally take its course? People used to walk in the hospital, they go, I don't want to kill my loved one. I'm like, there's no killing going on in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Your loved one's going to die, and you might try to intervene, or they're going to die naturally. And what Melissa did that was so smart is she really asked herself, this is not just about me. What would my husband say if he could see what's happening? What guidance would he give me? And that's the voice she listened to.
And I guess this also speaks to the fact that we should have these conversations with our loved ones early, before we get sick.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, people say all the time when I talk about advanced directives, they go, we're not sick. And I go, you don't have an advanced directive because you're sick. Mm-hmm. You have an advanced directive because you have a family. If you have a family, you should have an advanced directive.
Yeah. Finally, if there's one thing that you want us to take away from this moment that so many of us are experiencing collectively, what would that be?
Grief is isolating in a normal world. It's especially isolating now. Virtually connect with others. Take a walk with people. We have a grief group they can find at grief.com. Connect still with others. even during this time.
David, thank you so much. Your guidance means so much to us. Let me tell people once again that David's newest bestseller is Finding Meaning, the Sixth Stage of Grief. David, thank you.
Thank you.
I hope today's podcast was helpful in some way, and if it was, I hope you'll pass it along to others who might benefit as well. And please share it on social media and tag me when you do. I'm Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram, and I have a Facebook page as well. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday, and we air a new TV show every weekend on KTLA. All of those TV shows can also be found on YouTube. Thanks for listening this week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.